New York City is currently undergoing a major crisis with skyrocketing rents, placing affordable housing outside of the reach of thousands, if not millions, of its residents. But the struggle to provide New Yorkers with quality housing within their means is nothing new. And according to a new exhibit at the Museum of the City of New York, that struggle is a key part of the city's history. Affordable New York, a housing legacy, explores that long history going all the way back to the 19th century, placing it in the context of the city's current housing situation while looking to the future. The exhibit is at the MCNY through February 16th, but right now I'm very pleased to welcome its curator, Thomas Mellons, to our show. Hello.
Hello.
Now, normally we think of this sort of thing as the subject of a book, but not a museum exhibit.
Uh-huh, interesting. Well, I think that the topic of affordability in housing and people's access to it and whether there's an adequate supply is so much in the news that you literally can't open the paper, turn on the radio, turn on the television without encountering it. But we felt that people's awareness of this legacy, of the fact that neither the problem nor efforts to address it are by any means new, was lesser known, that it was in fact a kind of hidden history. And a museum show seemed like an appropriate way to be able to physicalize it.
Because we walk through it.
Absolutely. It becomes a kind of metaphor for our experience of the city.
When we talk about affordable housing, yeah, is that a strictly defined term?
Well, the government does define it as 30% as housing that does not cost more than 30% of a family or a household's annual income, although it does vary. And so even the government will say generally this is what it means in most parts of the country.
It used to be one quarter,
right,
of your salary, of your income, I guess, 1 week's pay. But now, hasn't Newsweek reported recently that the median rent in this city is currently 58.4% of income?
Yes, that is true. So there are many people for whom affordable housing does seem out of reach, although the percentages can be perhaps not completely instructive in the sense that 30% or even 50% of a very large income is very different from the struggles that many people face.
Is the housing crisis that New York City is facing right now the worst that we've ever had to deal with?
Well, I don't know that it's the worst, but it certainly is a serious issue that affects many people, that the mayor has made really a focus of his administration. The city has certainly gone through other periods where housing was a very significant issue. And in fact, Jacob Riis is a part of this story, the pioneering Danish-born photojournalist and social activist. And when he publishes How the Other Half Lives in 1890, it's really kind of a watershed moment in this history, not in terms of the existence of the problem or even government and philanthropic response, but in terms of public awareness. He really sort of blows the whole thing open. Well, it has been pointed out that in some ways the title, which is actually a quote from Stendhal, is in some ways a misnomer, which is to say that it's probably more accurate to say that at that time it was how three-quarters of the city lived, not just the other half.
Mm-hmm. Well, are we talking about a continuing problem or a string of crises?
I would say that we're talking about a continuing problem with certain moments of particular need.
Now, if you want to build and sell affordable housing, what are the biggest problems that the city and a prospective landlord has to deal with?
Well, New York is a very expensive place to build, and it always has been for a very wide variety of reasons, starting with the cost of land. But there are all sorts of economic and even legislative dimensions to that. So it's long been a challenge. On the other hand, it's also been a challenge that New Yorkers have met or at least faced very, very creatively for a long time.
I remember when Frank Lloyd Wright proposed that two-mile-high buildings be erected in the middle of Central Park, and they would take care of all businesses and everything. And then he'd have one-family houses dotted throughout the city.
Right. Well, you know, there is a certain anti-urban streak that runs through American history that you can see as being reflected in this particular emphasis on suburban homes and single-family homes. But I think that one of the principal points of the show is to look at the creative ways in which New Yorkers have addressed this and how New York has really kind of taken a leadership role.
On average, how profitable are apartments in New York? Does it matter whether we're talking about affordable housing? Do people make profits on affordable housing?
Yes, they do. And that's also not new, which is to say that some of the very earliest efforts to provide decent housing, particularly for workers in New York, came out of the private sector. They were not government initiatives. And in the 1870s, people started building so-called workers' housing. And they became known as model tenements or sanitary tenements.
Were they subsidized by the government?
No. And there was a strictly private initiative. Then there's a moment when that changes. But
that was seen as a philanthropic thing.
Yes, it was. But it was also practical in terms of a healthy workforce being good for business. But the people who were interested in doing this borrowed a phrase from their English counterparts, which, despite the fact that it comes from another country, seems to me quintessentially New York, which is to say they talked about philanthropy plus 5%. And so this notion that you could limit your profit, but not eliminate it. And so you would be doing the right thing, but you would make a few dollars in the process.
Well, that doesn't seem to be the case today. As far as I understand it, rents are increasing have increased by 40% in the last 20 years.
Well, but there's still a legacy of, in a sense, self-imposed restrictions on profit. First of all, there are many, many examples of the government incentivizing private development community to provide affordable housing. We see that throughout the city. But also, there are interesting examples. There were developments that were built by labor unions. An example of that is Penn South, built by the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. And that it's a limited dividend or a limited equity co-op, which means that you can buy an apartment there for a low price and you pay a low monthly maintenance in exchange for sacrificing the windfall profits that many people are now getting when they sell their apartments. And so you give that up for the existence of an affordable community. And that particular development has, on several occasions, repeatedly voted not to deregulate and to stay an affordable community.
And how many units are available there?
There are thousands. I mean,
not going to solve the big.
That alone will not solve the crisis. But I think that it's an example of New Yorkers not always being completely slaves to the bottom line, and that there's other goals and ideals.
I was speaking to Thomas Mellins, Mellins, curator of Affordable New York, a housing legacy. It's at the Museum of the City of New York, and it's running through February 16th of next year. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Thomas Mellins, curator of Affordable New York, a housing legacy at the Museum of the City of New York, running through February 16th of next year. What would the city look like if the government had never decided to subsidize housing?
Oh, that's a terrific question. The impact of government-subsidized housing in New York has been enormous. It really rebuilt whole precincts of the city, as well as the fact that there is much affordable housing in New York that benefits from the government's incentivization of the private community, what is sometimes referred to as public-private partnerships, that you walk by, that you and I walk by every day without being aware of what it is.
How is public housing and publicly subsidized housing different in New York from elsewhere in the country?
There are a number of ways. First and foremost, it was the first public housing in the country. The New York City Housing Authority was established in 1934, 3 years before the U.S. Housing Authority.
And then regulation of housing goes back into the 19th century.
Yes, it does, absolutely. The first government interventions in New York, again, setting a precedent for the nation, were the tenement house laws, the first one being in 1865. And sort of curiously, the first government intervention into the field of affordable housing didn't focus on affordability. It focused on conditions and establishing minimum standards. Going further than that, in a sort of odd way, it didn't really focus on housing, which is to say it was motivated by, or it didn't first focus on housing, which is to say it's motivated by public health concerns and the fact that tenements were considered to be incubators of infectious disease, particularly tuberculosis and cholera. And when the population at large began to be fearful that these diseases would spread, then the government did take action.
How much of the city's population lives in some kind of publicly subsidized or market-controlled housing?
Yeah, the numbers are hard to specify, but a minimum of 400,000 people are estimated to live in public housing, which is directly owned and operated by the city. The figure may be closer to 600,000. And then there are probably an equal number of people who live in other forms of affordable housing, not public housing, but subsidized housing.
We often hear the term Section 8 housing.
Yes. That's a significant component of the overall picture. And Section 8, as many people know, is tenant-based Section 8 has to do with the government essentially making up the difference between what a tenant can afford and what a landlord charges.
Now, as you mentioned, the New York City Housing Authority was founded in 1934.
Right.
How did Mayor LaGuardia use the New Deal to establish and grow it?
Well, Progressives had long dreamed of addressing a whole sort of array of social issues, housing being among them.
But Mayor LaGuardia was a Republican.
Right. But what I'm saying is that to sort of fast forward a little bit, there's a complexity to the fact that it's really the Depression that gives many people an opportunity to realize efforts that they had been focused on for quite a long time. So Mayor LaGuardia establishes this housing authority. But interestingly enough, one of the ways in which the public is invited to support this doesn't have to do with the provision of housing. It has to do with the provision of jobs, because you have to remember this is happening in the depths of the Depression. But the Depression did give the government an opportunity to step in where philanthropists had already established a record and build on a much larger scale.
But there were complaints from the start about this being socialism.
There were complaints, and there's a history of public support for public housing in New York, more so than in other cities, but there's equally a tradition of protest and opposition.
And projects, what we call the projects, are controversial even to this day, because they are both seen as the last resort for a lot of people, but also places where there tends to be more crime, more problems than you find in other kinds of housing.
Well, sometimes these developments are referred to, as you say, as the projects. People who live in them tend to prefer that they be called developments, and I think that they feel that sometimes the picture that's given to the public is not completely accurate. And that, in fact, there are an estimated 200,000 people on waiting lists for public housing in New York now.
How are they vetted?
There is a tenant selection process, which has changed over the course of the history of the New York City Housing Authority. In the beginning, it was quite a specific and rigorous process. And in fact, in the first 5 years of the authority's establishment, I think 174,000 people applied and 14,000 qualified. So it was a process. And
were the communities that the NYCHA wanted to create influenced at all by the thinking of utopian architects like Le Corbusier?
Absolutely. And in fact, I think many people associate the so-called towers in the park, the red brick buildings built on the large super block sites where streets have been blocked off and there's large landscaped areas. They think that that was an architectural paradigm that was actually created for public housing, and that's not true. It came, as you said, from Le Corbusier and other pioneering European modernist architects, and it was this whole notion of rebuilding cities, including efforts to rebuild Paris or visions of rebuilding Paris, as cities and gardens.
And as we learned earlier, in rebuilding Paris, houses were destroyed. Same
yes.
thing happened here. Where did the people who were being displaced move to?
Well, there were processes for relocating people. In some cases, people who had lived in Manhattan were relocated to other boroughs. But this was an issue from the beginning, and it was a point of opposition.
What role did Robert Moses play in the New York City Housing Authority's growth during the 40s and 50s?
Well, he played a very large role in the field of affordable housing altogether. There are many other initiatives besides public housing. Title I, the slum clearance program, very often included affordable housing components, and there are a whole array of programs. It's estimated that he was involved with the provision of about 150,000 units of affordable housing.
You quote Jane Jacobs, who was often went up against Robert Moses, as saying, quote, low-income projects become worse centers of delinquency, vandalism, and general society hopelessness than the slums that they were supposed to replace. And by the 1960s, many New York City Housing Authority projects had fallen into disrepair. Now, was it just simply neglect, or not enough money from the city to keep them going?
Well, particularly after 1973, when President Nixon declared a moratorium on direct federal financing of large-scale public housing throughout the country, certainly resources have been a major response. But in terms of the quotation, I thought it was important that the exhibition reflect a variety of points of view and show that this has been seriously debated, as well as resulted in a lot of very effective programs.
Well, why did he cut off the funding?
At that time, he did describe public housing as dreary and depressing, but I think that it fit into a larger issue of what the role of government was and what available resources were for all sorts of programs.
And then later, there was a destruction of that housing development in St. Louis, I guess, that has almost become an iconic film.
Yes, it has. That's the Pruitt-Igoe development. And one of the things, one of the many things, or several things that distinguishes public housing in New York from that in other cities is precisely that we have torn down virtually none of our public housing, whereas, as you said, it's been very well publicized in St. Louis. Detroit has torn down Cabrini Green.
Who pays more for subsidized housing in New York? City taxpayers? State taxpayers? Federal taxpayers?
It draws from all of those sources, and every program has a different and complex history of how it's been funded. But certainly all three sources are key.
Didn't the federal government announce a ban on smoking in public housing last week?
I believe so, yes.
Now, the New York City Housing Authority is going to have to enforce it?
I suppose that's another challenge. Yet,
how have the last five mayors, Ed Koch through Bill de Blasio, dealt with this? Have they been consistent in support of low-income housing?
Yes. I would say that Mayor Koch became mayor at a particularly important moment, not just in the city's history broadly, but in terms of affordable housing. You have to remember that there was a huge amount of disinvestment that was happening in the city, people literally walking away from property that they owned, and that impacted affordable housing disproportionately because many of those buildings in the outer boroughs housed lower-income people. The city, through an in-rem process, became the owner of an estimated 100,000 properties. And Mayor Koch is a critical figure in terms of government incentivizing private developers to build affordable housing.
These days, it's been reported that people are investing in housing stock, not moving to the houses, just buying them as investments. And Mayor Bloomberg even said, send us your rich people to buy apartments. But that is driving up the cost of housing.
Yes. There are myriad challenges facing the city in terms of remaining affordable broadly and particularly in terms of housing.
Didn't Bill de Blasio say he wanted to build 200,000 affordable housing units during his campaign?
Yes, he did.
What's happened to that?
Well, it's not just build. It's build or preserve. And in fact, I think that the plan does call for 60% of that 200,000 being the preservation of existing units and then 40% construction. In the first year, they did meet their goal of, I think slightly exceeded their goal of 20,000 units.
And then this July, he unveiled a plan for mandatory inclusion zone developments.
Yes.
What are they?
Inclusionary zoning has been an important tool for providing affordable housing in New York for several decades. And what, very, very simply put, what it means is that if I'm a developer, the city will allow me to build a bigger building than current zoning allows for if I agree to provide a certain percentage of affordable units. What Mayor de Blasio's plan calls for is that in certain areas of the city that are being so-called, or where it's proposed that they be upzoned so that you can build much more densely, that a developer who's building a residential building anywhere in that area will be required. So it will go from being voluntary to being mandatory.
And then there are scandals like two entranceways.
Yes, that's true. And the so-called poor doors.
Are we still building housing developments, public housing developments in the city?
For the most part, no, and certainly not on a scale that was seen between 1934 and 1973. But there are developments that are being redesigned, and there are collaborations between NYCHA and other government agencies to build affordable housing on the grounds of New York City Housing Authority developments, and that's a key issue and very controversial.
I've always wondered why they just didn't make these buildings more attractive. After all, it wouldn't be all that more expensive to get a decent architect to make them look less like just ugly boxes.
Right. Well, two things come to mind. One is that if you visit developments or if you look at plans, you can see that while apartments may be modest in size, very often they were designed carefully designed by skillful architects to provide multiple exposures so that you get cross ventilation, so that there's fresh air and light. And you have to remember that originally the people who were moving into public housing were often coming from tenements where this was a key issue. But I would also add that there is a tradition, particularly, I would say, starting in the 1970s, of hiring more well-known architects, Richard Meyer, and a whole variety of people have built affordable housing throughout the city.
Aren't they often also located far from public transportation in areas where nobody wants to live?
Sometimes that is the case, and sometimes that reflects the lower cost of acquiring the land, but very often that's not the case. And in fact, that's another point that distinguishes much public housing, not all public housing, but much public housing from that of other cities, is that it was actually carefully and well located with access to public parks and public transportation.
You considered the future as well in putting together this exhibit. What changes can we expect to see in New York City's affordable housing in the future?
Well, the mayor has proposed this change, which I think stands to have a significant impact on the city, which is to use inclusionary zoning more broadly. And part of that has to do with the way in which affordable housing would relate to the rest of the city and perhaps be knitted more into the fabric of the city than was achieved previously.
Because people don't still think not in my backyard. They don't want to live next to housing projects.
Well, but at the same time, people are happy to occupy new buildings, knowing that there's a percentage of affordable units.
Thomas Mellons is the curator of Affordable New York, a housing legacy at the Museum of the City of New York, which is running now through February 16th of next year. And I thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.